It was also true between Roosevelt and Truman, being Kennedy and Johnson, is that both Roosevelt and Kennedy were master politicians, but politics was one part of their lives. It was something they enjoyed doing. It was an instrumentality they used to do other things. But then there were a lot of other things involved with life. I think Truman, Johnson, politics is their whole world.
I know, and when you talk to either of them, you know, it's all they can talk about. Every little metaphor, my daddy down at the well, or Truman's fascinating about American history. You can just ask him anything, but you never can hear anything different from them. But, you know, Jack, I think a woman always adapts, and especially if you're very young when you get married and, you know, are unformed, you really become the kind of wife that you can see that your husband wants. So, if he'd wanted to, for instance, my sister's husband loves to bring his problems home. They're all business and leaders and understand that. But, you know, if Jack wanted to do that and talk about things at home, then I'd be asking him questions. He didn't want to talk about the things that were bothering him, but other things of his life. I mean, it was always, you have to read the papers and everything. Because he'd be rather irritated if he'd say, "Did you see Reston today?" And if you hadn't, you'd make sure you saw Reston the next day. Because if you'd say, "What did he say?" And he'd say, "Well, you know, you should find that out yourself."
His staff were victims of the same. At this meeting, in as I recall, in Johannesburg, was the real thing in which a kind of change took over place, in the sense that Ted, who up to that time had been handling working both on the speeches and the political side, was taken out of the political side, and Bobby and Canley and so on came in and really took over the whole question of political context.
Oh, yes, and I remember there was a rather bitter feeling for a while, or at least in Wisconsin, I think, Ted was bitter at Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
Ted didn't like whatever slot he'd been put into in the private. You know, there was a bit of friction there. But, you know, Jack could always trust Bobby. And I suppose, he planned his campaign that way. He couldn't always trust Ted. Ted had shown before that he wouldn't.
In questions of judgment?
No, that thing of profiles and courage, that was a real, Jack behaved like a great gentleman to Ted then, because Ted didn't behave very well that year. I mean, I'm sure that's not why he gave Ted the speeches or something. But, I must say, I couldn't look at Ted Sorensen for about 2 years after that.
He told what gave the impression he'd written it all.
Written the book, and he, of course, the poor boy, he was just starting, he was new in Washington, but he used to really make a conscious effort to go around. He'd take Jack's pages and things that he crossed out and added and, you know, really go out of his way to show them to people. And then when Drew Pearson said it, then there was the lawsuit where Clark Clifford came and defended him. And luckily Jack had saved all these pages of yellow legal pad that he'd written himself. And I guess Jack loved Clark Clifford then, because when he asked Clark to defend him, I think Clark might have been under the impression that Ted really had written most of the book. But he never asked that question. And then Jack got all those yellow pages and showed them to Clark. And Clark was just amazed and said, "These are the most valuable things you have. Lock them up. Everything."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I saw Jack writing that book. So, Ted would send down 50 books on Lucius Lamar and everyone else from the Library of Congress, and Jack would sketch it through, and Thaddeus Stevens and all that, and send, you know, it was back and forth in the mail, but, I really saw Jack writing that book, and I never liked the way Ted behaved then. But now, then he got to, his life was all around himself, and I think just in the White House he got to love one other person beside himself, which was Jack. So in the White House he was fine.
Was you as late as that?
Because
by the time, certainly Ted was the most seemed to be the most devoted and selfless, to the point of...
Well, let's see, Profiles in Courage would have been 55,
yeah.
56. Well, I'd say all through 56 and the beginning of 57. You know, Jack forgave so quickly. But I never forgave Ted Sorensen or watched him like a hawk for a year or so. But then as he had more to do, he didn't need to prove his little things. You know, and then Jack gave him, again, don't you think this is a nice thing? Jack gave him all the money from Profiles in Courage because he felt Ted worked so hard and he would work and stay up at night. And as I said, he worked slowly. He always seemed to have to stay up till 2 or 3 in the morning to get something done. Don't you think if everyone's saying that Ted wrote the book for Jack, then to give him the money from it, which he's made over $100,000.
That's right. Did Ted get all the royalties from
Profiles
in Courage? Yeah.
Because then when it was published, Jack thought it would just be...
That's fantastic.
You know, just a little book that would make, I don't know, sell, what, 25,000 copies or something? But then when it's zooming on to be bestseller, 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 Ted's gotten every bit of money from that book until... the memorial edition with Bobby's preface came out. And then from now on, it'll go to the library. You know, so...
Well, that's extraordinary. I never... So Ted must have made hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I know he made at least 100. But, you know, Jack wanted to give him something extra besides his salary, because the boy did just live, you know, and work hard all night and everything. But, you know, Jack was such a gentleman. I just think that was such a nice thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Bobby was in Washington in this period all the time, but it really wasn't until 59, sort of day-to-day involved with the...
Well, always when we were in Washington, we saw Bobby. It's just funny, just in the White House, we stopped seeing him in the evenings. When we went out, we saw Bobby, before we were married. When we always lived in Georgetown, you'd have dinner with him once, twice a week. And then Bobby, they talk about the McClellan Committee, the McCarthy Committee, you know, all the things that Bobby was on. But I guess then Bobby ran his Senate campaign, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
In 52? Did he?
In 52 and Teddy, and supposedly in 58.
But you know, Bobby was always sort of, well, they were both so caring what the other was doing. But then I guess, yeah, I suppose at that Thanksgiving meeting, Bobby just gave up everything else and did everything for Jack from then on. I remember what Bobby was doing in 58 that he couldn't run the campaign. Are you sure he didn't run it?
My impression was that Teddy was nominally campaign manager, maybe not. The labor hearings were going on, I suppose, at that time. That may have been the...
Well, that's a major thing I remember in Jack's life, but I can't remember what year it was. But I can remember every morning for breakfast, Arthur Goldberg would appear. Or George Meany and everyone, when we first moved in, that was the year for 57, we moved in our house because the first breakfast I bought these creaky old dining room chairs, and one of the first breakfasts, Jack and George Meany and someone else all went crashing to the floor. But all that year, you know, was seeing people for the labor bill.
Mm-hmm.
Me and Seymour Harris at spring, I remember.
Much more labor than foreign policy at that point.
Well, it was to get through the labor bill. Is it against the Landrum-Griffin
bill? The Landrum-Griffin bill came along as an alternative, which was eventually passed as a result of Eisenhower's throwing himself into it.
Well, anyway, Jack had one whole spring of working on that.
Mm-hmm. Must have been spring 59, I think.
Hmm.
But at the same time, he would do things like give a speech in Algeria.
Oh, yeah. And then I did that. I had to be married for my contribution to that because that was the summer before we were married. He gave me all these French books and asked me to translate them. And I was working for the Times-Herald, living alone at my mother's house in Virginia. And I'd stay up all these hot nights translating these books, and as I couldn't tell what was important and what was not.
What sort of books?
I mean, all these, they were all in French. En Algérie. No, this is Indochina, sorry, Indochina. That's what I did before I got married.
Yeah, that was 1951, 1952.
Yeah. Translate all, and Admiral D'Argentlieu and Ho Chi Minh and the Annamites and the Mennonites and the... I think I translated about 10 books.
Not and, the whole books?
Well, no, I mean, really right. sort They're of skimming through the page, but it was, you know...
Could he not read French?
Yeah, he could read French, but, you know, not enough to trust himself for a lot of facts and things. Mm-hmm. And then he would see, he was seeing a lot of French people then, and then they'd give some book. And the same, I did some for Algeria. But, you know, that was, and the St. Lawrence Seaway, again, I can remember that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all those things were so brave.
The Algeria speech was particularly so because it's sort of the whole consul and foreign relations crowd in this country are all outraged by it. I happened to be in Paris when the speech came out, and an old friend of mine, Jean-Jacques Servan-Schreiber of L'Express, absolutely lied about the speech and ran the full text and claimed to be the first magazine in the world which put the president on the cover. And I remember writing to him from Paris saying, pay no attention to these editorials from the New York Times saying how you shouldn't rock the boat, you were absolutely right, and the people in France who care about it are welcome this speech.
Oh, yeah. And remember when he went to Poland, he wouldn't take me because he thought it wasn't serious to travel with your wife. But, you know, he was always... he was always more interested, well, so interested in foreign things, but and then minimum wage, I remember, whenever that was. But, you know, all the things he cared about. I wouldn't know what year. But I remember him, example of him having a heart. I can remember him being so disgusted, because once we had dinner with my mother and my stepfather, and there sat my stepfather putting a great slab of pâté de foie gras on his toast and saying it was simply appalling to think that the minimum wage should be $1 or $1.25. And Jack saying to me when we went home, do you realize that those laundry women in the South get 60 cents an hour or 60 cents a day or whatever it was? And how horrified he was when he saw General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, I guess in their Camp David meeting before inauguration. And Eisenhower had said to him, they were talking about the Cuban refugees, and Eisenhower said, of course, they'd be so great if you could just ship a lot of them up in trucks from Miami and use them as servants for $20 a month, but I suppose somebody would raise a fuss if you tried to do that. You know, again, so appalled at all these rich people just thinking of how can you live on, not thinking how can you live on $20 a month to just use these people like slaves. He was just so hurt for them,
mm-hmm.
though he'd say it in a sentence. But that awful Republican sort of look. Oh, and then another time when you're trying to raise money for the Cultural Center, and a Republican friend of my stepfather said, you know, why don't you get labor to do it? If you took $1 a week out of all of labor's wages, you could have the money raised in no time at all. And he was just... I'm really sickened by that, and said, can you think of what $1 a week out of their wages would mean to all those people? Yeah, so all those things show that he did have heart, because he was really shocked by those things.
I think the most, of course he had heart, and he had the fact that, you know, it wasn't on his sleeve, and people had been so used to a kind of a certain sentimental style of expression of that kind of thing, but he was deeply affected. But he was cool as a and the fact that he was is why someone like Hubert, who is a man who I love, who's an admirable man, but nonetheless is can't connect with as many people as the president could, because Hubert is still is an earlier phase of reaction to this kind of thing. President enjoy the primaries in 1960? Apart from the fact it was a lot of great nuisance having to go through all this, but campaigning and so on.
Well, you don't know the exhaustion of the primaries, and he often said that the 4 days we took in Jamaica between Wisconsin and West Virginia were what made it possible for him to be president. Because he just worked himself into exhaustion, and then the second wind and the third wind. And when you get that tired, you don't enjoy them. And sometimes when we were in the White House and he'd go on, you know, some long trip, he'd get tired, sort of a campaigning trip. And he'd come home and say, oh my God, I just don't see how I got through those years. You know, I just don't see how I did it. I suppose when you stay that tired for that long, but then he'd lose his voice. And I don't think anyone enjoys working out of sheer exhaustion. And in Wisconsin, we'd go into a 10-cent store or something, three people in it. They'd back against the back walls. They wouldn't want to shake your hand. You'd have to go up and just grab their hand and shake it. Or little rallies in the town where you'd have a band and everything there and nobody'd show up. No, they were really hard. Wisconsin was the worst.
Worse than West Virginia.
Because in West Virginia, I was so amazed. I thought everyone would be there staring at us like...
These papists?
Yeah, and all that literature they were passing out about nuns and priests and everything. But the people were so friendly. There could be a mother with three blackened teeth nursing a baby in a rotting front porch. But she'd smile and say, won't you come in? In West Virginia, in Wisconsin, those people would stare at you like sort of animals. Jack would say, all this talk about the rural life is really, you know, overestimates it. Because the people are alone all winter long and cold and just with animals and they're so suspicious. Maybe it's because they're Nordic too, I don't know. But those suspicious people there,
You feel this was because he was a Catholic or because he was an Easterner, or were they equally suspicious of you? Anybody, Hubert or anybody.
I think that in Wisconsin they're just suspicious of anyone sort of gregarious. I mean, I don't think they like someone coming up or a band where, you know, or anything. And I think they were suspicious of him for all those reasons. Whereas in West Virginia, you know, they're a bit gayer even though they're so poor. But I never met one person in West Virginia I didn't like. Except for this strange man running around with his handbills wherever we spoke. And I never met one person in Wisconsin I did like, except for the people who were working for Jack.
Mm-hmm. When he was exhausted, he'd snap back quickly, though, wouldn't he?
Oh, yeah, you'd stumble into some hotel bed and you'd get up at 6 a.m. Yeah, he could snap back. He could have a day home and just sleep all through it. And you'd get all his laundry done or something in the daytime and pack him at night and off he'd go, or off we'd both go. He really could. And he could always sleep. He could sleep in the plane. He, almost like a soldier. I think that's where so many people's troubles are when they can't sleep.
Clem Norton, in that, I don't know if you've heard the tape of his, said, Teddy has a street personality. President didn't have a street personality.
That's true, he didn't. I mean, at the end, you know, he had that incredible thing, but Teddy's more 19th century. He can go down and tell stories. He was more like Clem Norton,
mm-hmm.
and more like Honey Fitz.
Mm-hmm.
No, but Jack never, he never said hi, fella, or put his fat palm under your armpit, or... You know, any of that sort of business. It was embarrassing to him.
But he didn't actively dislike campaigning. He quite enjoyed it, didn't he?
Yeah, he enjoyed it. I mean, if you asked him his three favorite things he could do in a day, I don't think he'd say campaigning. But when he got caught up in it and when it was going well, then he really liked it and responded. And the last, you know, as time went on, it was doing better and better. And he loved the people who really were glad to see him.
Mm-hmm.
They were little old ladies or children or what.
I always felt that when he went out as president on a trip and saw crowds and so on, he really come back very refreshed. Didn't you feel and filled with your energy and confidence?
It was so good for him, and he'd say how good it was to get out of Washington, mm-hmm. where it's this little group that just writes in and in and in. you know, little correspondence, hashing other. It was so good for him to get away and to see that he was adored. And, you know, it was great whenever he did that. And when he went to Europe this June.
The Third Conversation, Wednesday, March 4th, 1964.
Last time we were there, we were talking about the convention and the months before the convention in 1960, and the president's view of his various opponents and problems. And one of the things that always surprised me was the way in which liberals, the arguments I used to have with some of the older liberals and academics and so on about the president. It sounds very odd now, because no one obviously has done more for intellectuals in the White House since Jefferson. I suppose one of the big reasons for it was the whole McCarthy business. You knew McCarthy?
No, I didn't know him. I just went to see one of the hearings once.
Mm-hmm.
But Jack was sick the time of the McCarthy thing, wasn't he?
Yes,
and
he
I
was.
Suppose it was. And then they knew that his father had been a friend, or hadn't he been to the Cape once? I don't know.
He'd apparently been to the Cape once or twice, and...
Never when we were there.
But he wasn't in any sense a
no.
pal or a chum. Oh,
never. I just went out of complete curiosity once to see those hearings, and, you know, saw that man who was rather frightening. But I suppose they all thought that because of Mr. Again, I suppose the liberals all attributed to Jack being his father's son or something like that.
I think that was part of it. And also the fact that he didn't attack McCarthy. Though, as a matter of fact, very few members of the Senate, including people like Hubert Humphrey and Paul Douglas, attacked McCarthy. What do you suppose he thought of him?
I think he thought it was awful, you know, the way he was flailing around and handling everything. And then he did make some statement, either from the hospital, was it just before his operation, or he would have voted to censure him?
Yes.
But he wasn't there, was that it?
A speech was prepared for delivery before he went to the hospital. Speech was never delivered, and indicated that he was for censure. I think when the actual vote came, he was pretty sick, and I don't think any statement was issued at that time.
But you know, he didn't. I mean, he thought of McCarthy. Well, you know, poor McCarthy. I mean, if you saw McCarthy, then you see a man in his last. I think he was coming in and out of the elevator when I was standing there. Well, the man was just gone. He smelled a drink, and his eyes looked awful. You know, I think Jack thought just what everyone thought of McCarthy. But again, he was never anyone to run in the pack against.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, I suppose he had partly the political problem at home, didn't he?
Yes.
Of all, every single one of his voters in Boston, anyone whose name was Muck, anything they thought was wonderful. But I think he did that quite well.
Most of them, or a lot of them, thought McCarthy was probably a Democrat. No, I can remember in the times when you remember the old John Fox? Not the good John Fox, not Judge Fox, but...
Oh, the one who owned a paper?
Owned the Boston Post. At one time he started a kind of attack on communists at Harvard, particularly on me. And Jack was in town, went up and explained to him that I probably wasn't a communist, and I shouldn't be attacked. And later he told me about it, and he said as a consequence of that, he decided that John Fox probably thought that he was a communist.
Yeah, then Bobby was against McCarthy, wasn't he? Or was that later? When was Bobby's thing with Roy Cohn?
Bobby, well, that was about this time. No, was he?
Was Bobby working for McCarthy then?
Bobby was minority counsel. He was counsel for the Democrats
on the
committee. But he and Roy Cohn had worked with McCarthy. And then he couldn't stand Cohen's methods, and then he was associated with Symington, Jackson, and the opponents.
Yeah. You go.
He apparently was a friend of the ambassador's at some point.
Yes, not a great friend. But, you know, again, Mr. Kennedy was so loyal. There seems to be all these Irish. They always seem to have sort of a persecution thing about them, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
I noticed the way Mrs. Kennedy speaks even now about... is someone a Catholic or are they Irish? As if it's a, you know, I guess they've had such persecution.
Mrs. Kennedy can remember what it was like to grow up.
Yeah, but she even will say now when you say you know someone's coming for dinner, is he a Catholic or is she a Catholic? As if that will make them nicer.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a timidity. So I'm sure Mr. Kennedy, who was rather conservative, you know, might have just liked Joe McCarthy this was before everything bad happened, because he was Irish, because he was Catholic, and because everyone else was down on him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, never going into anything deep in it, because they never talked about him at home.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly never told Jack, you know, to be for or against him. I mean, it was a messy situation Jack was in. And I think he did, you know, putting out his censure and everything. And they hated it in Boston.
Yeah, it was a very difficult local situation on it. What about the Nixons? Did you ever see the Nixons in the Senatorial Lawyers?
No. I used to see her at bandage rolling. You know, the Senate wives have to go roll bandages every Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And the vice president's wife is always the chairman of it. She's dressed in a white nurse's uniform. That's the only time I ever saw her.
Mm-hmm. I should be perfect at a bandage. Bandage roller. But about 1960, the primaries, and you remember the Wisconsin primaries being the hardest, did President ever at any point seem worried about the outcome, or was he too absorbed day to day to that feeling? Was he up and down, or was it a fairly...
Well, you just had to work so hard. You know, when you're really in a campaign, you don't almost have time to think of the outcome, though he'd be going over polls and the this and the that district. But I remember election, a primary night in the Hotel Pfister in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
You know, that was awful. It was so funny. We were all on, just like on nails. And then it came out sort of a draw. Well, it was just so awful because there everybody put all they had into a fight and you were just left exhausted and you saw it had proved nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have to start again.
Mm-hmm. No, that must have been were you in Washington?
And I remember that awful man, Miles McMillan, who wrote for the paper in Madison, who was married to, the girl he's married to, Rockefeller, was
also
married to Proxmire. Well, he used to write all these anonymous letters to the paper saying scurrilous things about Jack. He was a terrible man. Again, a wild-eyed liberal creature. He came cruising through the apartment that night when we were all in there counting the returns. And, it was awful of me. I walked by him twice without saying hello, cutting him dead. Jack. I mean, I was so mad at him. Jack was polite.
West Virginia, like you said, is more agreeable.
Well, the people were just nicer there. And, you know, you went slugging along again. But, and then there for the first time we separated. And I go off with someone on my own little tour. You know, in and out of little shops or a little bar or all those little mining towns. And the people were so nice to me. You know, just tiny little... never more than 10 or 20 people.
Would you speak or just...
They'd just say hello to them all and talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and tell them who I was, and I'd have someone with me. Who was it? Did I go with Franklin? Because he was usually with Jack. Then every night we'd be at some big rally where Franklin would talk.
Mm-hmm.
But then you see in the middle of that campaign, I started to have John. So then I was sort of rather sent home a bit. I just was there about the first half.
Had Franklin been an old friend, or did he become a particular friend in West Virginia?
No, he'd been a friend of Jack in Congress. You know, they were always running around and busy and everything, but they'd always liked each other. And then I guess we saw them a few times when we were married. Yeah, we used to see Franklin, so he always was a friend. Mm-hmm. Not constant. But you could always laugh with him, and he amused me, and he and Jack amused each other. So, and then I went off with Franklin in Wisconsin, I remember. We went all through one color district together, and all through supermarkets where no one looked up at us. That's when he became, in Wisconsin, he helped there too. Mm-hmm. But West Virginia's where we saw the most of him, and from then on he was a very good friend.
West Virginia began to get a little bitter. Well, I guess you're pretty bitter in Wisconsin with Hubert.
Oh, and all, yeah. I guess it did, because what they were saying, just as Jack said, a fight always gets bitter. The Humphrey people were saying the Kennedys were buying election, and the Kennedy people wanted Humphrey had any military service, and I forget what else it was. Mm-hmm. But, Jack didn't say any of that. He was mostly trying to prove why he wasn't dangerous as a Catholic.
Which he did, completely, of course. He won in West Virginia 3-1, as I recall, something like that.
Yeah.
And then after that, did you...
Do you want to know something interesting about the night that we won there? Mm-hmm. I guess that night was just too frightening. You know, we didn't want another night like the Hotel Pfister. Uh-huh. So we came back to Washington, and we had dinner at home with the Bradleys, and we went to a movie.
What was the movie?
We've been going to some movie at the Translux, but it was half over, so we went to some strange movie in New York Avenue, just the only movie that was sort of open we could get in. It was some awful, sordid thing about some murder in California. Really, just morbid. And then we came home to our house, terribly depressed by this movie, and waited for the phone to ring. And I was in the pantry getting some ice cubes, and suddenly I heard this war whoop of joy. And they called Jack, and it was, it just was fantastic in West Virginia. So then we all got on the plane and flew down there, mm-hmm. and got there in the middle of the night. But, he was so nervous about it, he just didn't want to be there. Mm-hmm. So we had this strange little evening of not wanting to be by the radio, the phone, anything.
Is that that's the only election you ever did that, isn't it? Most of the other time you always listen to the radio.
The other times you're always there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I suppose this really is so much a make or break thing. And after this, did it seem pretty clear sailing?
Well, I guess it did to Jack, because then it was to get really to go around and talk to people, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And keep speaking more. What month would that have been?
Well, that was May. And then in June, there was President Truman's attack. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Experience. Is that upsetting much? Or?
It was just one more thing to, swat down like a buzzing fly. But I remember when he answered that, because that was on his way out to the convention. Mm-hmm. So June and July, what did he do? Well, then there was the long session of the Senate.
That was after the convention.
Was that after the convention? Well, June and July, I guess he was mostly in Washington, wasn't he? Wasn't the Senate still in session then?
Yes. And then, the convention was in July.
Oh.
It was earlier, because the Democrats were out of office. And then he came back, and the special session began in August.
Then whenever he came up to the Cape for a weekend, a day, you should have seen in our little house, there'd be 50 Lithuanians arriving with folk dolls for Caroline or something at 11 in the morning. Then they'd go, then Tom Mboyo would come, and then Governor Stevenson, and then Norman Mailer, then just in and out of our house and everyone on the street outside. I'd started to build a stockade at the convention. But I only had it half finished. Mm-hmm. That split fence.
Yes.
So Lee and Stash were staying with us, and everyone could see them getting in and out of the bathtub because they had went a room on the street. It was rather close living that summer.
About the convention, were you or the president ever alarmed by the way things were going at the convention? For example, all the Johnson effort or the Stevenson picket line or anything like that?
I was at home at the Cape with my mother and stepfather and Janet. I was the only person in the whole compound because I was having John.
Mm-hmm.
And I was panic-struck reading the papers. Well, Jack would always call me up, usually terribly late at night, or say something would be all right, or not to worry, or this or that. I suppose he was worried about me worrying, having a baby. Oh, but I was panic-struck watching him. But I guess they weren't as worried out there, because Bobby told me that once he got to the convention, he knew they'd get, you know, he'd get the nomination.
They would, the president would call you every day, and Bobby, would he call you?
No, Bobby told me that later.
Mm-hmm.
No, Bobby didn't call me.
So you missed, of course, the sort of the business of the great Stevenson.
Yeah, I just saw it on television.
And Lyndon saying, but you saw all the things like the debate between the president and Lyndon. And you missed Lyndon's people going around saying, talking about Addison's disease.
Oh, I remember that because when Lyndon Johnson came after the convention to our house at the Cape, we moved out of our bedroom. It was a very small house there so that he could, and Lady Bird could have that room. We were sort of sleeping in a single bed in this tiny little guest room. And then we had to go over to Mr. Kennedy's, which was where all the press would meet the next day. And Lyndon plunked himself down in Mr. Kennedy's chair. I was just thinking, do you know what chair you're sitting in after the things you said about that man?
Mm-hmm.
And any time Lyndon would talk that night, Lady Bird would get out a little notebook. I've never seen a husband and a wife so. She was sort of like a trained hunting dog. He'd say something as innocent as, I don't know, does your sister live in London? And Lady Bird would write down Lee's name in London, just everything. I mean, she had every name, phone number. It was a sort of a funny kind of way of operating.
Mm-hmm. You're like a hockey team.
Yeah, well, you know, just she always had these three green notebooks just filled with everything.
We talked about this the other day, but it was not on the tape. So you were about the problem of Lyndon's going on the ticket.
Oh, well, I think everyone was disappointed because of all the people they liked Lyndon Johnson the least. And I must say, Symington behaved awfully nicely there, didn't he?
Yes.
You know, you never thought he was any great statesman or anything, but he was just such a gentleman the way he did that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I know that made Jack sad. I even wrote Symington a letter, which I asked him to burn. And he wrote me back that he burned it, saying I wish he had been the vice president. But I know Jack had to do it because have Lyndon as his part, as his running mate, to annul him as majority leader. Because here this man with this enormous ego would have been just enraged and blocking Jack in every way. And yet you know, and keeping everything in. I know he kept that session in before the convention.
I think he called it before the convention.
Yeah, because that was it. So Jack couldn't get out and campaign and do more things. I mean, he'd done something before to really make things difficult for him.
I recall it was called before the convention, but it took place after.
Hmm. Well, he certainly didn't make, you know, if you'd had him up there with that enormous ego and thwarted and bitter, so nobody was happy about it. Everyone was even amazed that he accepted.
Mm-hmm.
I think, well, some other people can tell you about it, going down into his room and everything, and I guess he was drunk.
Phil Graham was a great go-between, and told me, I have notes somewhere, at the Friday, I went out and had dinner with Phil. He gave me a great account of his role as kingmaker, intermediary. I think Joe also thinks that he was responsible for getting Lyndon on the ticket.
Gosh, I don't know, but I suppose Bobby could really tell you all of that, because
Bobby was against it.
But I mean, Bobby knows. All I know is that a call was placed at something like 8
That's right,
o'clock in the morning, and Lady Bird answered, and Lyndon was still asleep. And then Jack went down. Lyndon said he'd come up. Jack said no, he'd go down to his apartment. Lyndon just accepted right away.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what had gone back and forth. And they all were rather surprised.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if all these people were kingmakers or not.
Joe and Phil waited on Senator Kennedy on the Tuesday and said he had to put Johnson on the ticket. The president said nothing. And but then subsequently, the press, according to Phil, the president called him, and I forget where this, and asked him about calling, what he should do about calling, said, I want to go ahead with Lyndon. And I think then the president called Lyndon directly. Lyndon was asleep, and then all this business started. And then later the thing seemed to get off the tracks, and Phil was called in to kind of put it together.
I see. What else was I just thinking now? Can't remember.
Before the president went to Los Angeles, did he talk very much about, did he speculate about vice presidency?
No, he really didn't. He was at the Cape, and I flew down with him to New York, and we stayed at, did we stay the night at that Idlewild Hotel, or else I just saw him off and went back to the Cape, you know, and said goodbye to him. I guess we did stay the night, because the Truman thing was sometime. But he really didn't. You know, it was more just to get it himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that all obviously happened in those 4 or 5 days there.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever get permanently mad at people?
Never. And then I used to say to him sometimes, you know, it was so funny in politics. It was always, I mean, it was all everyone talked about every night, and I'd hear him speaking nicely about someone. And I'd say, what? Are you saying nice things about X? But I've been hating him for 3 weeks. You know, if I saw him in the street, I was going to make a point to just glare at him and cross over to avoid him. And Jack would say, no, no, that was 3 weeks ago. Now he's done X, Y, you know. And, I mean, in politics, things do change so quickly. And Jack would never, he'd often say that, never getting anything so deep that you've lost all chance of conciliation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he never treated it. What did he say? Politics, you don't have friends or enemies, you have colleagues. That isn't quite the right.
Palmerston used to say, there are no permanent friendships and or alliances, there are only permanent interests, something like that.
Yeah, but he never got, I mean, I get terribly emotional about anyone, whether it was a politician or a newspaper person who would, you know, be unfair. But he always treated it so objectively, you know, as if they were people on a chessboard, which is right. I mean, how could you if you, you know, if he'd gotten so mad at all those people, then you may need to work with them again later.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the only way to be effective, which is one reason I think women should never be in politics. They're just not suited to it.
You know, he was a great realist in that way, and didn't because everyone, I remember in Los Angeles, everyone felt as soon as Lyndon attacked the ambassador that this finished him. But that's because of the theory that developed of sort of Irish feuding. You know, too many people had seen John Ford films, which, and didn't.
John Connolly was the one who was going around saying Mr. Ken, about Addison's disease too.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and the day before Jack died in Texas, I said to him, I just can't stand Governor Connolly. I can't stand his soft mouth. He was so pleased with himself, and he'd spent all our times in the car telling Jack, I guess, how far he'd run ahead of him in Texas. So I said, what's he trying to tell you? It seems so rude what he's saying to you all the time. And Jack said, oh, well, he's been making up with a lot of businessmen down here, and gotten a lot of support he didn't have before. That's what he's telling me. But Jack would just sort of take it, you know, yeah. And then when I said that I hated Connolly, Jack, so sweet, he sort of rubbed my back. It was as we were going to bed, and said, you mustn't say that. You mustn't say that. He said, if you start to say, think that you hate someone, then the next day you'll act as if you hate him. And then we've come down here to Texas to heal everything up. You know, and you make it all impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Nellie Connolly was refusing to ride with Yarbrough. Everybody was refusing to ride. And there were two people named Yarbrough, and I don't know. Everybody was hating everyone. And you know, Jack said, just, you know, you mustn't think that about people. He said it so kindly.
Mm-hmm. And the same way with the Stevenson people. When you think that the top people on the Stevenson Drive at Los Angeles were George Ball, Bill Wirtz, and Tom Finletter. All of them were immediately...
Oh, yeah. I know, I think it's so good to be able to forgive quickly. I know that that's a quality that Jack liked in me being married, that if ever there'd be a slight little, you know, cloud, I'd always be the... I'd rush and say, oh dear, did I upset you? Did I say something wrong? Or I'm so sorry? Or, you know, or and he loved that, because I think it's hard for men to make up first in, you know, in a family, a rather intimate way. But he did that same thing. I can't do it in my life outside marriage, but he did that same thing outside.
Mm-hmm. Would he ever get depressed, or was it his temperament just terribly equable?
Oh, his temperament was terribly even, except when he'd be in pain for a long period of time, for instance, his back, and when he'd have done the three or four usual things, which is go to stay in crutches 4 days, if that doesn't work, go to bed for 2 days, or, you know, have a hot pack or something, and if it just seemed to stay on, he couldn't shake it, then he'd get very low, but just because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But if he had something to do, he'd get up and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually it would get better. But in the beginning years of our marriage, ill health was... just seeing Jack in pain used to make me so sad all the time. But really after... I guess after the Senate thing, it didn't seem to be as much of a problem anymore.
Mm-hmm. 1960, his back didn't trouble him much, did it? During the campaign? Or...
No. I mean, he had the best health in the world. I think one reason was he was doing so much too much. When he got in the White House, he took this nap every day. It was just 45 minutes. He'd come. Who could be bothered to get in their pajamas for 45 minutes? And he'd hit that pillow and go to sleep and wake up again?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I couldn't sleep. You know, it would take me 45 minutes to doze off, but it was so good for him. Then all his back and his stomach and everything weren't always plaguing him.
Mm-hmm.
He just always overtaxed himself. And so he never was in better health or spirits than all his White House years.
Did he ever have trouble sleeping?
No.
Never took sleeping pills? Never, just always?
Sometimes in a campaign, he would take one tiny little sleeping pill. You know, if you got in late and you had to get up early and you were in some awful smelly hotel bedroom. I remember once there was a whiskey bottle under the mattress because the, the American Legion had a convention in that hotel there before. And there were whiskey bottles under all our mattresses. Well, you know, just to make sure he got to sleep so he'd be awake the next day. But a little tiny thing, and then he wouldn't the rest of the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you needed your sleep. My gosh, you only got about 4 hours. And I remember I tried not to take any. And you toss and turn, so then I'd borrow one of his sometimes.
Mm-hmm. You were in Hyannisport all the summer of 60 during the special session.
That's right.
The president, and then, of course, you were there all autumn.
I went to... let's see, I did a lot of things in the spring in Georgetown, and then I went to New York for that ticker tape parade. And in the debates, I went, the first debate I saw in my house in Hyannis and had people down from Boston. The second one, whichever one was in New York, I was there
mm-hmm.
for.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one I was in Washington for. the third or the fourth.
Do you remember how he felt when the whole question of debates came up?
Oh, well, I remember, you know, he'd the one in New York, which was the one I was with him for, how he just had piles of briefing books and he had sort of a busy day, but then he'd sit in a room for 2 or 3 hours and he had about 5 people there giving him every conceivable awful question you could think of. I mean, he really prepared for it like sort of an exam. And, you know, was so confident. No, not so confident, but, you know, wasn't moaning or groaning or worried or anything. And then when he called me up at the one in Washington, the minute it was over, that was, I guess maybe it was the second one in Washington, because he said on the phone, they had the temperature here down to 30 degrees below zero or something, because I guess Nixon had perspired on the first one. Sort of laughing, but he really was quite confident.
What did you think during the first debate?
Oh, well, I thought what everyone else did, I just couldn't believe it. You know, it was so obvious. It was just so clear. That really changed everything. Jack always told me the thing that changed his 52 campaign, this was before we were married, was his appearance on Meet the Press with Lodge. He said that that was the hump, and then everything started to go his way. Well, that first debate was, you know, I always thought it, but I was so glad that it was just so obvious. Because you could just see he'd won it and hear it in the street and everywhere.
Was there any talk before that about the, I mean, the president obviously thought that the debate would be a great opportunity if he could get it, but didn't suppose that Nixon would go along. Do you remember any of that?
Not really. I remember sort of talk on and off all spring about the debates or not. I don't know what made Nixon finally decide to.
It was his great miscalculation. And I think he did it because he'd been a champion debater at Whittier College. And thought that he could win. I'm sure there was no... I think he thought that this would make the experience point if he would get up there with this young kid.
But I remember the talk in the evenings of which debate would be, wasn't one foreign policy, one domestic, and one... I remember all those evenings when they were hashing out, you know, a lot of people would come and they'd decide how the debates would be made up. But I don't really remember the leading up to it part.
I know you weren't, because of John, weren't around long all the time in the campaign. Do you have any impression on whom the president relied particularly in campaign strategy and the like?
Well, himself, really, because, you know, whenever he was home, you'd hear him calling, and, I mean, he'd be telling, you know, he'd always be telling people what to do. I suppose he did rely on Bobby, didn't he? Most of all. Bobby.
And he always checked his judgment of Bobby. He didn't always take it, as in the case of Lyndon Johnson, but I think he always wanted to see what Bobby would react, how Bobby would react.
Then his father was always, you know, it was, I'm so glad Mr. Kennedy had a chance to do something. But, you know, he would be taking Billy Green to Pavillon or something, and maybe that was all before. But, you know, he talked to his father, too, but more to hear what his father reported. You know, all those old men.
John Bailey, did he matter?
Oh, yeah, well, John Bailey, I don't really know what...
He was then chairman of
the
committee.
You know, we always loved John Bailey. That's the first place we ever went when we were married, and Jack made a speech in Connecticut. But, no, I don't think he was calling up John Bailey for advice.
As far as whatever I saw, it seemed to me he was really... running the whole show himself.
And then as he'd say, and Bobby would say, and everyone, you know, nobody must ever get mad at the candidate. So that's where what Bobby was sort of the buffer. And, you know, everyone who had a fight, or then somebody hated Ted Sorensen in some state and somebody else, you know, there'd be 2 chairmen, and which one would be the one. All those things Bobby would have to do so that those people wouldn't get mad at Jack. Mm-hmm. You know, which Bobby gladly did. That's another reason. You know, he got the sort of image of being someone people dislike, but he had to be so tough for Jack.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby said that to me the other day. You know, it's so nice to have someone for you, you know, who can fight your fight. I mean, be the one that people get mad at, not at you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just the way Frank Morrissey used to tell me that the candidate could never be the one to leave the room, so Frank Morrissey would have to haul him out.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd always be protesting, "No, Frank, I don't want to go yet."
Yes.
But you always had people to protect you and do that for you.
Tell us about the last day before the election.
Well, everybody was at the Cape. Oh, no.
You went to Boston. And
yeah, we woke up in Boston, so we must have slept there the night before.
There was a big rally at the Boston Garden the night before. I think you were there, weren't you?
No, I wasn't. I was at the Cape, so I must have gotten up very early and been driven to 122 Bowdoin Street.
Mm-hmm.
And from there we went to the voting place. Then we flew down to the Cape and the Caroline. And, you know, and then that long day started. And I remember we had fish chowder. You could still sit outside. And it's so funny talking about the longest day. Who should come running out from the garage and sort of servant's part but Cornelius Ryan, who'd written The Longest Day with a print of a picture. So, we both said, "What are you doing here?" We didn't really know him. He introduced himself. So then Jack started questioning him all about the longest day and the this and the that part of it. And you should ask Ryan about that. And I guess he'd gotten in it through Pierre. Then take walks and you go over to his father's house, to Bobby's house.
What kind of a day was it?
It was a cold fall Cape day, you know, very clear. But I know we lay out on the porch with blankets on us, sort of in the afternoon in the sun. Then he'd go over. Bobby's house had been turned into just a, you know, command post. I mean, radios, telephones, boards, workers. But Jack kind of stayed away from that. And then dinner,
How did he seem?
Sort of restless but quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd go over there, then he'd try to take a nap.
He wouldn't speculate about things anymore.
Oh, no, he wouldn't talk about it. I mean, it was, you know, you had what he loves, his fish chowder. Then, I mean, he was picking Cornelius Ryan's brains about the longest day. That poor man was so amazed. You know, then we'd take a little walk, because you knew that the really bad part wasn't going to get till night.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I forget which house we had dinner at, but afterwards we were all watching it in our house. And then Connecticut came charging in,
mm-hmm.
And I said to Jack, "Oh, you know, now you're president now." And he said, "No, no," very quietly. And so I watched till, I guess, about 11:30 or 12, and then everyone knew that it would be an all-night thing.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was sent up to bed, and all the, it was so sweet, Jack came up and sort of kissed me goodnight, and then all the Kennedy girls came up, and, you know, one by one we just had sort of hugged each other, and they were all going to wait up all night. And Jack slept in the next room that night. So when I woke up in the morning, I went flying into his room to see, just to hear the good news, to hear that he'd heard sometime while he'd been awake. Didn't know there wasn't anything.
But he'd gone to bed eventually.
Yes, he went to bed, I think, about 4 or something.
Mm-hmm.
And this was about 9:15 or 8:30.
Is he still sleeping when you came in?
Yes.
You woke him up?
Sprang in, you know, and there was nothing. So then I woke the poor man up. And then you get up and then everybody walked around. You've seen those pictures, you know, in raincoats. And up and then the press people were sort of gathering. And I guess it was about noon or 1 o'clock that the word finally came.
Nixon finally conceded it.
And then, then we, the night to see the press in Ethel's house, all those women saying, "What kind of first lady will you be?" Those horrible women. And then we all had our pictures taken together in you know, the big house. And then we were all going to go down to the armory, and Mr. Kennedy didn't want to come. So Sweetie always tried to stay in the background. And I remember just grabbing him and saying, "You have to come now." He was so sweet. And we all went down to the armory.
John, can you talk?
Don't talk.
Hold it a little farther away from there, like that. John, you went to the airport today.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
Yes.
John, what happened to your father?
So, he's gone out to heaven.
He's gone to heaven?
Yeah.
Do you remember him?
Yeah.
What do you remember?
I don't remember anything.
You don't remember anything? You remember when he used to come and run into his office?
Yeah.
And he'd play with you?
Yeah, but can you put John on?
Okay, we'll put John. Do you remember when the president knew he was going to be president? Did he say anything, or did he just sort of take it in the stride?
Well, I think we were all out somewhere, and someone yelled, you know, Nixon's conceded. I think by then, you sort of knew by the votes that it was bound. It was just sort of waiting for Nixon to concede, wasn't it?
Yes.
So, when it came, what could you do? I mean, you know, hugged each other, but...
Would you say he was a religious man?
Oh, yes. In a...